Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Assassins. They walk around the world in broad daylight, carrying out their orders in silence. Shadows that vanish into darkness the instant any light falls on them. And chances are, you've seen one without even knowing. There exists a shadow world where terrible things occur on a regular basis. From illegal websites found in the darknet to clandestine contract killing organizations, assassins lurk everywhere. You may have heard of such infamous contract killers, such as Bugsy Siegel or Alexander Solonek. Perhaps you've heard of other assassins, but chances are, if you've heard of them, then they're not professional hitmen. Professionals in this field are ghosts that are never found, not even in death. Picture the following. A woman walks into a busy hotel and checks herself in under the name Lily Parker. She goes to her room where she changes into a leather jacket, jeans, and boots. Then she checks her phone to go over her target's details once more before loading her G17 with a fresh magazine. However, lurking in her room is a shadow of death. With one swift motion, this shadow whispers a word into Lily's ear. She then stares at her G17 for some time. Outside, a light snow begins to fall and stick on the windows of Lily's room. As the snow continues to fall, a flash of light illuminates the window for a brief second. Then, darkness. I'm Agent Kai, and I've decided to make my reports for Lyos in the form of a podcast. My hope is that you, dear listener, will discover the truth of this world and open your eyes to it. The lobby of the Oslo Plaza Hotel was cold and silent that evening. While I waited for Inspector Eric Kaldager and Hotel Manager Annette Larson, I sat down and winced from the pain I still felt from my shoulder and ribs. The flight here had taken a toll on me. Luckily, I had the morning to get some much-needed rest and recovery. And with the help of Biofrost, Lyle's designed healing spray, my injuries were experiencing a quick recovery. However, it would take several more applications before I was fully healed. Aside from a woman in a ponytail lost in her phone, there weren't many people in the lobby. Every now and then, a person or a couple would walk past toward the bar or out the door. The snow outside had intensified and was being whipped around by the wind. At 8:15, some of it entered the lobby when a tall man in a cashmere overcoat walked inside. It was Inspector Kaldager. I stood up to greet the man.
"Dir Gott Uta," he said, rubbing his gloved hands. "Ah, Dumavare, Mr. Kurt."
"Ja, they're correct," I said.
"Ja, Valen Kurt.
It's a pleasure to meet you, Inspector Kaldager."
"Ja,"
his phone rang.
"Please, Mr. Kurt, permit me a moment."
Inspector Kaldager and Miss Larson, dear listener, were under the impression they were meeting with Valen Kurt, an investigative journalist for the British newspaper The Artful Archive, who was investigating the apparent suicide of 25-year-old Lily Parker. And while Larson may have agreed that Lily Parker's death was a suicide in public, privately, she believed something else entirely. Larson was convinced that Parker was killed by the ghost of an assassin that haunted the Plaza Hotel. This assassin, dear listener, went by the name Jennifer Fairgate. Of course, this was not her real name. It was only a legend. She was a guest of the hotel back in 1995 and died in room 2805, a supposed suicide. But, according to Larson and many of the hotel's staff, They claim to have heard and seen Fairgate walking in and out of room 2805. Some even claim to have seen the woman running down the hallway and then disappearing before reaching the elevators. And since Lily Parker was staying in the same room, well, it meant her so-called suicide was, in fact, a ghostly murder. Coldagger, on the other hand, believed Lily did commit suicide for the fact there was blood splatter on the G17 and the left hand that Lily used to take her life. The facts spoke loud and clear. This would have been a no-brainer had not one of Laos's intelligencers, a security guard for the hotel, witnessed the ghost of Fairgate themselves several times throughout their career there. This intelligencer reported that Fairgate meant no harm, at least up until Lily's arrival, and out of an abundance of caution contacted headquarters. While Coldagger was on the phone, Annette Larson arrived with a faint smile painted on her face.
"Sorry to keep you waiting, Mr. Court," she said. "As you can imagine, things have been hectic here."
"Ah, hardly a moot day, Fru Larson," Coldagger said. "Have you made sure no one has moved a thing in the room?"
Larson nodded.
"Yes, Inspector. Besides, I couldn't get a cleaning crew in there even if I wanted to. The staff is too afraid to go in there alone."
"Nonsense! There's nothing unnatural here. Simple suicide is all."
Coldagger turned to me.
"Make no mistake, Mr. Court. What took place upstairs is nothing more than a lonely woman who couldn't survive in the world."
"I'm not so sure about that," she frowned. "Come, let's go upstairs before I lose my nerve."
The first thing I noticed when we entered room 2805 was how cold it was. Larson explained that ever since Fairgate's death, this room was always cold even with the AC turned off and windows open in summer. She shivered and said she would wait out in the hall until I had everything I needed.
"So what is it you plan on writing, Mr. Court?"
Coldagger said. "Well, I plan on writing the truth. I examined the bed where Lily Parker's body was found. There was still blood on the covers and on the mirror across from the bed. Many believe Miss Parker was an assassin or perhaps a spy who was murdered along the lines of Miss Fairgate." Coldagger nodded.
"And what do you believe?"
"I'm not sure what to believe yet. Do you have the photographs?" Coldagger pulled out a folded manila envelope from his coat's pocket. Then he produced the photographs and handed them to me. The pictures displayed Lily Parker laid out on the bed, crimson staining her brown hair and hand. Her G17, the gun she used to end her life, was on the floor, also painted red. She was wearing tight-fitting jeans with an expensive-looking leather jacket and Christian Louboutin ankle boots. I wasn't much of a fashion expert, however, the red soles of the boots gave them away, and I knew this only through Patrice Landless, who always wore some of the world's most expensive clothes and enjoyed discussing designers and their products. The fact Lily had on $1,000 boots told me she wasn't planning on killing herself. No, she was going out, either to eliminate her target or survey the land. There was something else going on here. "Her clothes are expensive," I said.
"Are they now?"
"Let me guess. All of her clothes have no labels or any identifiable markers, do they?" Coldagger shook his head. After a moment's hesitation, he explained that all of Lily's clothes had their labels torn off. He wouldn't say anything more than that. Whether Coldagger knew it or not, one of the first things any assassin learns about this fatal trade is stealth. A professional killer must learn to become a ghost, to disappear in broad daylight. Tearing the labels off of their clothes was one way to remove any identifiable markers. In truth, professional assassins and Lyle's agents weren't much different. Both knew how to blend into a crowd and how to vanish from it within the blink of an eye. The only difference, if any, was that a Lyle's agent knew how to play with words and conversation to make sure they weren't remembered by anyone deemed insignificant. As I examined the pictures in more detail, I noticed a small rectangular mark on the corpse's stomach. Lily was wearing a white shirt underneath her leather jacket. The rectangular mark was also white, but a different hue of white. It was a sloppy cover-up job. There was something on the corpse's stomach that Coldagger didn't want me to see. I had an idea of what it was, but I needed to make sure. "What else was found on the body?" I said.
"Just what she had on her,"
is that right? I studied the photographs once more. Would this rectangular smudge happen to be covering up a metallic card? Kaldagger stared at me, wide-eyed. How'd you know that? I've seen this type of murder before, Inspector Kaldagger. Murder? A few things to understand about the world of professional killers, dear listener. There is a shadow world filled with living ghosts who you've seen but don't realize you've seen. I'm not talking about spirits of the afterlife. On the contrary, I'm speaking about living human beings who have perfected the art of invisibility. Professional assassins tend to fall into two categories. The first is murder for hires. These are the killers you can find on the dark net. One such place was the Bessa Mafia. Here you could request to have someone killed for a price. If you Google it, you'll find the story behind it. I've deemed it unnecessary to explain this dark website, as it is of no relevance to this report. The second is contract killing organizations. These are where the real professionals reside, unlike the former, where, usually, wannabes, amateur killers, or undercover agents lurk. One such killing organization is Apophis. This clandestine killing organization is one of the oldest in existence. Apophis, or as it is sometimes known throughout the Dark Net, the Lord of Chaos, is known to recruit and train some of the best assassins unknown to the world. And for the right price, Apophis will send their highly trained assassins to eliminate targets large and small without leaving a trace. If, on the rare occasion, their assassin is terminated by the target, the assassin's remains are disposed of by serpents, cleaning crews, before authorities ever know what happened. But what of the target? Apophis always has another, even better, killer ready to go and finish the job. Which brings me back to Lily Parker. She was well-dressed and armed, but her boots were loud, which meant she was confident in her ability to handle herself in any situation. And judging by the sterile condition of her hotel room, she was meticulous in making sure no identification marks were left behind. All trademarks of a highly trained Apophis assassin. No Apophis assassin would commit suicide. They would have been screened for such a weakness. So what happened to her? Inspector Kaldagger pulled out a metallic card and handed it to me. We found that card on her stomach. The card was made of a smooth metal and had, in gold, the symbol of a crook and flail engraved. And we found this one in her jacket pocket, Kaldagger said, handing me another card. This one was made of the same metallic substance, only it had, in gold as well, the symbol of a snake curled 6 times over. What does it mean? Kaldagger paused and thought for a moment. We had the lab analyze the metal. It's of unknown origin. This is very interesting, Inspector, I said. I wish I knew what it meant. Like I said, I've come across similar murders where these metallic cards were found on the body. You keep saying murder. Why do you say this? I just assume. I mean, with these cards, you can't help but wonder if maybe someone killed these people. This could have been a staged suicide. Kaldagger nodded. And you're putting this in your article? Not without proof first. Good, Kaldagger said. Because this is a suicide. Forensics proved it. Case closed. I told Kaldagger that he knew better than me. Then I returned the photographs and the cards. He pocketed the items back into the manila envelope. Had he taken the time to inspect the cards I had given him, he'd see that I switched the originals with low-grade, blank metallic cards. It never failed to amaze me how little care the majority of people put into the things they do. Whether that was due to overconfidence, lethargy, or just being jaded with their profession, the majority of people in this world were easily deceived. Perhaps that was because, on some subconscious level, they wanted to be. Before heading out of room 2805, I took one more glance around. The room was colder than it was when I first stepped inside, despite the heat being cranked up to 26 degrees Celsius. Then, I looked over the window and saw the reflection of a woman with short dark hair standing on the side of the bed. She looked up at me, a frown painted across her ghostly face. When I turned to see where she was standing, there was nothing there. Thank you. After thanking Inspector Caldagger and Miss Larson for their time, I made my way over to Maimo for dinner. Victoria Lakatos was right. The food and drink there was fantastic, especially the roasted lamb with a glass of Domaine Loret Messigny Grand Cru. On my way back to the Hotel Continental, where I was staying, once again, courtesy of Patrice Landless, I noticed the woman in the ponytail from the plaza lobby was tailing me. She was pretending to be speaking on her phone, but her eyes gave her away. And if I had any doubt she was following me, the fact she circled around Studenterlanden Park with me twice before heading toward the hotel erased any lingering doubt. Judging from her gait and her stern American accent, I determined her to be CIA. I pulled up my coat collar and buried my hands into the coat pockets to fend off the cold and snow. I knew the CIA officer wouldn't try anything yet. She was only housing me for now. Therefore, I made my way back to my Continental suite at the Hotel Continental and left my unwanted visitor in the lobby. Back in the suite, I fixed myself a glass of Tadenzay and examined the metallic cards I had swiped from Caldagger. The first, the one with the engraved snake found in Lily's pocket, was the ID card carried by all Apophis assassins. This ID allowed assassins of this organization to communicate with employees who worked in the shadow world for Apophis. These employees provided the assassins the world over with guns, tactical gear, legends, ad nauseum. There wasn't a doubt now that Lily Parker, which probably wasn't her real name, only a legend, was a killer for Apophis. That explained the first metallic card. However, the second one, the one with the engraved crook and flail, sent a cold chill down my spine. This card, dear listener, has been found on the dead bodies of assassins throughout history. Some of the most recent to have had this card placed on their corpse were Jennifer Fairgate, Tamam Shud, and now Lily Parker. All these professional killers, and many more dating back to prehistoric times, were victims of the crook and flail, or as this assassin has come to be known throughout the shadow world, Osiris. Legend has it that this specific Osiris has been killing killers since the dawn of time. Now, whether it's one being doing all this killing, or multiple people throughout the ages that have donned the name, is a topic of debate. No one knows anything about Osiris. The only information known about this phantom comes from an eyewitness who has seen the assassin and lived to talk about it. The supposed witness, Ahmed Massoud, now a professor emeritus of Egyptology at Cairo University, claimed to have seen Osiris back in 1938 when he, Massoud, was 7 years old. His father, Said, was a tactical gear provider for Apophis stationed in Cairo. One night, the young Massoud overheard his father speaking with someone in the living room. The voice of the stranger, Massoud later recalled, was deep and profound. Curiosity struck the young Massoud. He got out of bed and tiptoed to the living room to catch a glimpse of his father's late-night visitor. When he'd stationed himself behind a large plant that his mother kept in the living room, Massoud caught a glimpse of the visitor. The visitor was tall, probably around 6'5", and muscular. The visitor was wearing a cowl and a large trench coat that reached down to the knees. First thing that caught Massoud's eye was the visitor's legs. They weren't wearing any pants, it seemed, but rather, their legs were wrapped up in gauze. No boots or shoes were worn, just gauzed feet. Then, the visitor turned in Massoud's direction. The visitor's face was completely gauze except for the eyes. Two dark green circles with yellow glowing orbs peered at him. Massoud later said that when he stared into the eyes of that late-night visitor, he felt an odd combination of fear and respect. The next morning, Massoud asked his father about the late-night visitor. His father said the gods were good, that they had nothing to fear so long as Osiris watched over them. What Massoud's father implied was that the late-night visitor was Osiris himself. Now, Osiris, dear listener, in Egyptian mythology, was the lord of the dead and ruler of the Duat, the underworld, husband to Isis and brother to Set. Osiris was also associated with death. While Anubis is often credited as the god of the dead, the fact is Anubis gave up the title when Osiris became the ruler of the underworld, after his brother, Set, cut him up into pieces and his wife, Isis, put him back together by mummifying him with the help of Anubis. Now, whether the Osiris who assassinated Lily Parker and all those assassins throughout history was the Egyptian god himself was left to be seen. The only thing I knew was that I was dealing with a highly skilled assassin who may or may not be immortal. I contacted Cameron to inform him about my discovery.
"Jesus, Kai," he said.
"Are you sure it's Osiris?" I told him I was.
"And what about the ghost haunting the plaza, Fairgate?"
"Fairgate's ghost is there," I said. "I saw her lingering in room 2805, but she's not the one who killed Parker." I told Cameron that while Fairgate's ghost was wandering the halls of the Plaza Hotel, she wasn't there to haunt or kill. Judging from her frown, I'd say she was dejected rather than murderous. I didn't pick up on any malicious activity in that room, which meant that Lily was killed by something or someone living.
"All right then, I'll set up a crow watch for you," Cameron said. "Watch your back, Kai. If you're right about this Osiris, then they are probably watching you as we speak."
Cameron was right. If it was the legendary killer of killers, Osiris, then it meant they were watching me, probably from the instant I arrived at Oslo Plaza. And if they were watching me, then they would have followed me back to the Hotel Continental. They would have seen me staying in the top Continental suite. They would wait until I turned off the lights and went to sleep before making their move. A clean kill. And that's exactly what I did. I got into bed and turned off the lights and feigned sleep. The cawing of crows echoed in the night air. In order to understand what happened next, dear listener, I must explain what a crow watch entails. You may remember me saying I signed a crow watch on Miss Lakatos in my previous report. A crow watch is exactly what it sounds like. Usually a murder of crows or at times an unkindness of ravens, keeping a close eye on a selected target. If you ever seen a murder of crows, a large gathering of these fine feathered birds, in one place, then it means they're busy keeping an eye on someone or something. They watch and send back messages using an electromagnetic signal, a special cawing, that travels through the air and is picked up by a receiver that decodes their special calling and translates it into a desired language that is displayed through an app. These Lyos-trained crows and ravens have been used throughout Lyos' remarkable history. The Lyos trainer responsible for training these avian creatures is known as the Ruf-Nagud, a title assigned to the person in this position. Currently, the Ruf-Nagud on duty is Camilla Halverson. She trains and maintains these intelligent birds. According to Patrice Landless, the crow watch was a surveillance tactic given to Lyos by Odin, the father of Norse gods, himself. Therefore, all the crows and ravens used by Lyos are descendants of Hugin and Munin, Odin's ravens. It was 12:30 when my watch, which was linked to the crow watch, set up by Cameron, chimed once, then vibrated 4 times, an indication that my target was upon me. The first thing I noticed was an unfamiliar voice saying the word pestis in my head. It was repeated slowly with the S's stretched out so that it sounded more like pestis. In order to avoid this word from infecting my mind and body, I had to clear it by focusing on the word and gaining control of it with my voice. This was no easy feat. The unfamiliar voice was domineering. However, after a few tries, I was able to overpower that voice with my own. Once this happened, I immediately replaced the intruding word with Vita, then combined it with Eterna, Vita, Eterna. When I was able to rid myself of the infectious word, that's when the strong, musty smell overpowered the room. Then, I saw them. A tall figure standing at the foot of my bed, draped in the room's shadow. The only thing I could make out was the dim yellow eyes staring at me. They didn't move, just stood there, watching me for what felt like several minutes. The yellow eyes dimmed out of sight when a faint click reverberated throughout the suite. It didn't take long for the other stalking shadow to enter the bedroom. This one wasted no time in making their presence known. I had to roll off the bed in the blink of an eye to avoid the silenced shot that pierced my pillow. While on the floor, I reached into my pant pocket and pulled out an illuminator, a marble-sized flare. I threw it at the wall across from me. It shattered into pieces upon impact, releasing intense light with every broken shard that flew into the air. This light, dear listener, is said to be harvested from the sun itself. Therefore, having your eyes open when the illuminator is activated will cause temporary and at times complete blindness. I opened my eyes after 30 seconds of the illuminator's activation. The room now had a dim glow, and I could see who the second shadow was. The CIA officer was rubbing her eyes and trying to regain her vision. I stood up and disarmed her. Then I had her sit down on the living room couch. I pulled a seat in front of her and aimed her gun in her direction. After a few minutes, once the government assassin could see again, I said, "Why are you trying to kill me? I don't have to tell you shit." The government assassin, trained to never leak information about their handlers or a country. These professional killers will end their lives before submitting to the perceived enemy. At least that's what their superiors would like. However, every person has a breaking point, even professional killers. A well-trained assassin can take on loads of pain. Some can even handle having their body parts cut off and still not speak a word. You see, these types of killers are trained to embrace pain. After the initial wave and shock of pain, they focus on nothing but the pain and let it overtake them. The goal? To have the pain knock them out, or better, kill them. Lots of governments around the world practice medieval torture on captured spies in order to make them talk to this day. Unfortunately, this barbaric tactic doesn't work. All it does is force the spy to lie, to tell their captors what they want to hear. Lyles has a phrase for this, the witch confession effect. That is, saying whatever your tormentors want to hear in order to stop the torture. Therefore, a Lyles agent is taught to extract information through psychological means rather than physical torture. On average, threats tend to work. I used this tactic when I was on assignment in Colombia. But this only works on civilians. Government-trained operatives are a different story. Like all good assassins, these government-issued ones tend to be orphans or antisocial personality types. Threats won't work because there's nothing to threaten them with. So, in this instance, a small dose of fan taste would do the trick. Fan taste, dear listener, is a reality-altering substance devised by Lyles. This substance, which comes in the form of a fine powder, takes its inspiration from the Greek god Phantasos. This mixture forces the user to experience a fantasy of suggestion. Depending on the amount of the powder ingested, the user could spend several hours, days, weeks, months, or even years in this suggestive fantasy, while in reality only taking minutes. And while you may think that this sounds like a wonderful escapist drug, think again. Once the user has ingested fan taste, the body becomes severely ill, forcing the body to attack the remnants of the substance. In other words, the body will believe this substance to be a virus harmful to the body, meaning that if a user tries to ingest fan taste again, it will have no effect because the body's immune system would eliminate it immediately. Of course, if a person has a disciplined mind, fan taste will have no effect on them. However, there are far and few who have such a mind. My hopes were that this CIA officer was weak of mind. Otherwise, I would be forced to use a more frightening approach to extract intel. I opened the pillbox I had in hand and scooped a pinch of the powder. I wonder what your superiors would say if you completed this mission. I then blew the powder into her nose. It didn't take long for the fan taste to take effect. The CIA officer, who revealed her name to be Tara Mayer, entered the suggested fantasy. She began to debrief her superiors about her completed mission in Norway, how her whole mission, Operation Serpent, had gone wrong from the start. Tara was to meet her contact, a supposed Apophis assassin named Lily Parker, in room 2805 of the Oslo Plaza Hotel. Lily Parker was to reveal the secrets of Apophis and name names of active assassins and higher-ups. But when she arrived and didn't receive any text from Lily, Tara knew something was wrong. When she heard that a guest at the hotel was found dead in room 2805, Tara became convinced that another Apophis assassin had killed Lily to silence her. Therefore, she stalked the hotel for a few days, waiting to see if anyone suspicious showed up. Finally, after a few days of Lily's death, a man claiming to be Valancourt of the British newspaper The Artful Archive appeared. She never heard of the newspaper, so she Googled it. It turned out to be real. Even this Valancourt was real. His credentials checked out. But there was something about this man that didn't feel right. The way he observed his surroundings, his calm demeanor, and his stride, always alert. There was no doubt in her mind. This man was an Apophis assassin, probably the one who did Lily in. Tara mentioned how her superiors, after receiving this intel, told her to kill this possible Apophis hitman. Of course, Tara, being one of the better assassins for the CIA, decided to house Mr. Court first, just to be sure he was more than what he seemed. Once she saw Court's expensive taste at Miami and the Continental Suite at the Hotel Continental, Tara was convinced this man was no journalist. So, she waited in the lobby to make sure the man didn't suspect her. Shortly before midnight, she went to the lobby bathroom where she prepared her ghost gun by adding a silencer. Then, she tucked it into her jacket and made her way up to the 7th floor via the staff elevator. When she broke into Court's suite, she noticed a strong, musty smell. It reminded her of something old and dead. She wondered if the bastard had been killed by another Apophis assassin. As she made her way through the suite, she couldn't help but feel like something was watching her. At one point, she said, she could have sworn there was someone behind her. Every time she felt the sensation of being watched, the musty smell got stronger. She shook the feeling off and continued toward the bedroom. When she reached Court's room, she found him asleep. She took the shot. Clean kill. Then, she left and headed for the airport. A minute had passed, although for Tara, it was days that had gone by in her mind. For the next several minutes, as the effects of the fan taste wore off, Tara vomited into a bucket I had provided for her. Then she shivered violently. I provided a blanket for her to wear, but she threw it off. She stood up and pulled out two daggers from her belt. Clever. I hadn't thought to check her belt for weapons. "Who's Apophis?" she said, fighting off the shivers. "And what the hell did you do to me?" "You're going to be fine," I said. "I gave you a substance that made you talk." "You liar! I don't recall saying anything to you." She threw one of her daggers. I managed to dodge it, but it grazed me on my left arm. "Tara, you need to settle down," I said, wincing from the pain. "Your intel is wrong. The CIA should have no business with Apophis. If they try, it won't go well for them. You're better off telling your superiors that Apophis is a hoax and nothing more." "Yeah, of course you'd say that." Tara flipped a dagger in her hand so that now she was holding it by the blade. "You're an assassin for Apophis, aren't you?" "No, I'm not."
"But I am."
The voice from before, the one from my head, echoed throughout the room. The light bulbs from the lamps and chandeliers all exploded until only darkness was left. Standing by the glass doors that led to the balcony was the silhouette from earlier. Once again, the only distinguishing feature, the yellow glowing eyes.
What?
Tara said. She took her dagger and shot it point blank at her visitor. The knife struck them right in the chest. The visitor, however, did not flinch. Instead, they pulled out the knife and threw it on the floor. Tara cursed and engaged the visitor in combat. "Tara, stop," I said. Tara was well-trained. Most CIA officers don't receive much hand-to-hand combat training. But for someone like Tara, a professional killer, martial arts training was a requirement. The style she was using here was Krav Maga. Ordinarily, the attacks she delivered on our visitor would have incapacitated anyone, probably have killed them. But no martial art in the world would have been effective on this killer of killers. Tara managed to land several punches and a roundhouse kick on our midnight visitor. She didn't leave a scratch on them, and she knew it. And the second it took Tara to glance around the room to look for a weapon to use on her opponent, Osiris whispered, "Pestes." Tara's head shook several times before coming to a stop. Then, she crouched down to pick up a large shard of broken glass from the shattered light bulbs. She held it in her shaky hand and stared at it. "She needn't die," I said, aiming Tara's gun at Osiris. "Let her go."
"It's much too late for that, I'm afraid."
Tara fought to keep her hand down, but in the end, she took the shard and stabbed her throat several times until a river of crimson flowed down her chest and soaked her clothes. She dropped to her knees and stared out the glass doors at the falling snow before landing in a pool of her own blood, lifeless. Osiris flipped the corpse over. They then placed a metallic card with a golden engraving of a crook and flail on the corpse. "She didn't have to die, Osiris."
"Ah, I'm still called by name,"
Osiris said.
"You must know that she chose this life. I feel no pity or sympathy for a killer. She must have known that one day she would meet her end this way. It's inevitable in this line of work."
They turned to me.
"You're a different breed, however."
I lowered the gun. "Why'd you kill Lily Parker?"
"A story as old as time,"
Osiris said.
"She defected. Apophis has no time for such weak-willed individuals. But you are not that. You were able to conquer my word. Very few have ever accomplished that feat. And for that, you've earned your right to live another day. Not that it will do you much good. Living can be worse than death."
Osiris opened the glass door. A piercing cold wind blew into the suite. They stepped out onto the balcony, where artificial city lights revealed not just their trench coat, but the gauze that wrapped around their entire body. If I didn't know any better, I would have said that I was looking at a living mummy. They pulled their cowl over their gauzed head and jumped off the 7th floor balcony. When I got to the balcony and looked down, I caught Osiris, once again a shadow in the darkness, disappearing around the corner of the hotel. Using my smartwatch, I activated the crow watch once more. Within minutes, I could hear the cawing of crows overhead. Wherever Osiris decided to run off to, I would be right behind them. Words, dear listener, are powerful. They have the ability to paint a picture, lift spirits, break hearts, and to command. Osiris' method of killing wasn't through violent physical means, but rather psychological. They could whisper an infectious word like pestis into your mind and hijack it along with your body. Said in the proper tone, the word pestis tricks the mind and body into believing that its own existence is an infection that must be eliminated. Therefore, the mind tells the body to eliminate itself. In other words, a mind hacking. I wasn't sure of it at the time, but I had a feeling that the infamous killer of killers, aka Osiris, was not an identity handed down from generation to generation. On the contrary, I believed Osiris was the same being since the dawn of time. Their ability to survive a combat knife to the heart and their comment about living being worse than death is what gave me the hint. It would explain how Osiris was able to infect the minds of their victims by whispering an infectious word that forced the victim to kill themselves. Hypothetically, if a person were to live for ages, their minds could transcend beyond what we know of the capable mind today. The myth that we only use 10% of our brains is nonsense. A person uses their entire brain daily. However, a brain in use for countless millennia, well, the possibilities of such a mind is beyond today's comprehension. Using the crow watch, I tracked Osiris to the Dyckman Bibliothek. Thanks to an unusual cold winter, They were standing on the frozen fjord. They knew I was coming.
So, you decided to follow me after all. I see the Allfather's birds are still up to their old tricks.
You're immortal, I said, walking up to them. And you've spent lifetimes killing. Why?
It's all I ever know. My memory spans eons, yet I remember nothing about my childhood, about how it came to be like this. Family, friends, nothing. But those souls I've taken, those I remember each and every single one. I wonder if I was brought into existence to do nothing but kill. Oh, how I longed for death.
They pulled two Perrin daggers out from the back of their trench coat. They threw one at me.
Perhaps you'll be my Grim Reaper.
Osiris lunged at me with their dagger. I parried their attack and returned with one of my own. Our daggers locked for a moment. I held a stalemate until I heard the ice cracking beneath my feet. I sidestepped and started for solid ground, but was intercepted by Osiris.
"'Tis a strange time the world is in, where fjords freeze and hovering shadows stalk the earth."
"Hovering shadows stalk the earth," I said.
"Aye, those are my words. I've been alive for a long time, and I've seen some strange work done in this world. But the hovering shadow of a man in a trench coat is by far the strangest."
"The Gentleman Unknown."
"I'm sure he goes by many names. A Gentleman Unknown to you, a hovering shadow to me."
They spun and launched their dagger like a missile my way. I sidestepped again, avoiding the piercing tip of the blade, but received a cut on my side. It started to snow.
"I can relate to this Gentleman Unknown. You see, I've no memory of what my real name was, if I ever had one. It's funny what the mind chooses to forget over a period of time. But I've been called many things. Among them, Death, the Pestilence, Grim Reaper, and as of late, Osiris. And who knows, perhaps these names are right. I am Death. I have outlived and killed so many people and things. Living forever, it's a curse. What you aren't told is that while you may be immortal, it doesn't mean your body is. The mind is what lives forever. The body will still decay. Remain intact, yes, but decay. I had begun to decay, and was becoming a hideous sight for the mortals. Therefore, finding myself in Egypt at the time, I visited an old friend of mine, Saeed, who recommended I mummify myself to preserve my ravaged frame. And so I did, and came to be known as Osiris."
Osiris opened his trench coat to reveal his entire body wrapped in gauze. They went on to say that their vocal cords were destroyed along with their body. Therefore, at some point in their lifetime, they had a voice box surgically implanted where their vocal cords used to be. I said, "How long has this hovering shadow been around?" Osiris swung their dagger at me once more. I blocked the attack, spun around, and sunk my blade into their chest. If there was a heart there, it would have stopped beating. Osiris told me that was game, and he asked me for my name. Kai.
"Very good, Kai. Your Gentleman Unknown, he's a newcomer in the world of the weird. Did you know that the Dykeman Bibliothek has commissioned several writers from around the world to write novels that won't be published before 100 years from now? I'll live to see and read those books. Will you and your shadowy friend?"
As I examined the accordion-like building, I noticed the Gentleman Unknown watching us from the roof. Osiris told me that he was watching me, that they had to wonder whether they were watching me out of fascination or intimidation. The snow picked up, and as the snowflakes increased in size, the Gentleman Unknown blurred into the night sky until he was out of sight. I turned to Osiris, and before they disappeared, I asked them for a favor. They owed me, since I defeated them in the duel. The next morning, I found myself drinking a cup of coffee in Oslo Plaza's Gaio restaurant. After my encounter with the immortal assassin, I checked into the Plaza Hotel for the remainder of the night. As I sipped my coffee, I wondered whether Osiris would keep their word of releasing the soul of Jennifer Fairgate. You see, the spirit of Fairgate remained in the realm of the living because she couldn't let go of the anger and shame of having been forced to end her life. Therefore, I asked Osiris to speak to her restless spirit and ask for forgiveness so that she could move on in peace. When I finished my second cup of coffee, I put on my coat, still wincing from the old and new wounds that stung my body, and left the hotel. I was headed toward a local bookstore to pick up a copy of Hamlet when I was approached by a woman with short black hair wearing a leather jacket. She looked at me for a moment and smiled. Then she said, "Thank you," before vanishing into thin air. I looked up at the clear blue sky and smiled. Caldagger's final report stated that Lily Parker committed suicide for unknown reasons. Like Jennifer Fairgate back in 1995, a background check on Lily yielded no results. The name and identity provided to the Oslo Plaza was a fabrication. In the end, no one claimed to know Lily Parker. She was buried in Vestre Gravlund in an unmarked grave. Caldagger and myself were the only people in attendance at her funeral. No report of a metallic card with the golden symbol of a crook and flail was ever released to the public. The memory altering unit went to work at the Hotel Continental hours after CIA officer Tara Mayer expired. The MAU staged the entire Continental suite to look like Tara had an intense night of drinking and, in the throes of depression, killed herself. The suite that was originally under the name Valencourt was changed to Tara Mayer. She, too, was buried in an unmarked grave in Vestre Gravlund, when her name turned out to be a fabrication. Like the assassins before her, no one claimed to know who she was, nor did anyone attend her funeral except me. According to the latest update by the Crow Watch, Osiris was last seen in Melbourne, Australia. The intentions of this immortal assassin there are unknown. However, this agent would like to believe that Osiris might be paying a visit to the restless souls that died by their word and asking these souls for forgiveness. The Lyles Intelligencer, who was stationed at Oslo Plaza, reported that the ghost of Jennifer Fairgate was no longer a resident of the hotel. Patrice Landless has reviewed this agent's request to investigate the gentleman unknown. Without official proof that this being has committed the wrongdoings in Colombia, Tokyo, or in the States, the case filed for this investigation has been labeled pending further review. The world is a harsh mistress. Take a close look at the world and you'll notice that it's full of cold hearts and frozen souls. Everyone is trying to survive in an otherwise cutthroat environment. Because life is hard, and nobody cares for their fellow human. Instead of extending a hand to those in need, the person turns the other way. And even if someone were to extend their hand to a person in need, that person in need, given the opportunity, may take advantage. Thomas Hobbes suggested that people don't care or know if they're doing right or wrong. They're doing what is in their best interest. Laws remedy this. However, just the fact that it takes laws to force people to act right is problematic. Immanuel Kant believed that at the heart of the human, there is a selfish will whose struggle to get better is an achievement only an individual alone can accomplish. This is so because a person's moral compass must be directed toward their duty to humanity and not self-gratification. No one on earth can force a person to perform their moral duty to humanity. The person alone must come to this realization. Clandestine organizations such as Apophis and Operation Serpent are run by individuals whose only interests are self-serving. Instead of using their resources to further humanity as a whole, to perform their moral duty to humanity, they, instead, go about sneaking around in the shadows of the world to fulfill their selfish agenda. Lily Parker, a top-rated assassin for Apophis, may have decided that her organization was doing more harm than good. Therefore, her decision to reveal Apophis' secrets to the CIA may have stemmed from her inner moral compass. It's possible to believe that deep down, Lily felt an intelligence agency like the CIA may have been able to stop an evil force like Apophis. It would not be surprising, nor far-fetched, if Lily had planned to speak to other intelligence agencies about her employers as well. Unfortunately, in a world where chaos and immortality are the majority, and morality and reason the minority, performing such a deed alone is not only dangerous, but next to impossible. The world of assassins may seem exciting and stylish, especially the way Hollywood and the media makes it seem, but the reality is the complete opposite. The life of an assassin is a cold and lonely one. Many assassins, professional or wannabe, end up dead and forgotten. And for what? Nothing. In the end, an assassin is nothing more than a pawn in the chessboard of life. Jennifer Fairgate, Thamam Shud, Lily Parker, and Tara Mayer were victims of a heartless society. And for someone like Osiris, who has lived for eons in the shadows, their very existence is a curse. They are doomed to walk this earth alone in the dark, stripped of their memories, their humanity. This agent can't help but wonder if Osiris' immortal coil rotted because of the countless kills committed by their hand. Perhaps if Osiris had decided to help humanity instead of punishing it, then their flesh may still be fresh. Kant's ethics on morality, that is, doing your moral duty to help humanity because, like it or not, it's your duty, is on point. It would be a dream to have a warm and caring world where cold hearts and frozen souls were thawed, where selfishness was no longer a trait. But so long as the world is hellbent on encouraging selfish nature and violence, this agent fears that the state of the world can only hold out so long before it collapses on itself.